It's already one of the most horrifying cases of alleged serial killings in the history of Canada, and it might get worse.
Well, Toronto police have resumed excavation at the Mallory Crescent home linked to the investigation into alleged serial killer Bruce MacArthur. The remains of
Bruce MacArthur was charged with 6 counts of murder in January. That's now 8 counts, and that could rise. Late yesterday afternoon, police were seen carrying a black bag away from the area they'd been searching. But until his arrest in January, some of his alleged victims had been missing for more than 6 years without a trace. Why did it take so long for the police to realize a serial killer was targeting Toronto's gay community? And what does this latest news mean for MacArthur's trial and for a community still grappling with a killer who lived in its midst?
Accusing our community of not helping and not coming forward is like probably one of the biggest lies I've ever heard.
It's July 5th. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story.
There's so many problems here that are going to need to be sussed through and addressed. But they should have been dealt with 8, 9, 10 years ago, and they weren't.
Justin Ling has been on this file since before the police were investigating these disappearances as murders. He's written for the Globe and Mail and Vice News, and he's currently working on a book about the case. We called him while he was standing outside the house where police have recovered 7 sets of human remains so far. Justin, where are you right now?
So I'm sitting on a little traffic island called the Mallory Green, just at the end of Mallory Crescent, outside of the property that police are searching, of course, the property where they've already discovered the remains of 7 different men and where they expect they could find potentially more human remains over the next couple of weeks.
What's it like there today?
I mean, honestly, it's hot. It's mostly quiet. I mean, there is obviously, you know, what sticks out is that there's, you know, maybe almost a dozen news vans here. You know, a command vehicle from the Toronto Police, there's OPP officers, canine units, but And this sounds weird to say, apart from that, it's relatively quiet. You know, some of the neighbors are sort of milling about. I talked to a couple of the neighbors here who, you know, are a little obviously perturbed that they're going through all this again. The cops only left here a couple months ago. Now they're back. But again, you know, it's a muggy, warm day and nothing terribly exciting is happening. Of course, it's going to be a painstakingly slow process. The cops expect they're going to be here 2 to 3 more weeks. There's a police tent set up in the backyard of the house. So this is going to kind of be a fixture of the neighborhood for the next couple of weeks to come.
What happens if they do find more remains? Are they expecting that?
I don't know what they're expecting, to be totally honest. There's certainly a possibility that there are more bodies. And certainly, and it sounds gruesome to say, but police have expected that there would be more body parts yet to find. Whether or not that means additional victims is still unclear, but it's certainly possible. I heard from one neighbor who said that they had seen who they thought was Bruce MacArthur digging in the backyard last August, maybe about 6 months before he was arrested. And that seemed to be the area they're sort of combing now. When they first searched this property in January and February, even into March, the ground was frozen. So they couldn't do the excavation of the backyard that they needed to. So obviously now that it's thawed, now that they think they know some of the areas where the cadaver dogs suspect there could be remains, they're going to do kind of a painstaking inch by inch excavation of the soil in the backyard. And that could be where they, where they potentially find more of these remains.
There's reporters there now, you know, the story is now a book, which you're writing. There's a huge feature on these killings in Vanity Fair, which just arrived yesterday. How long has it taken for this to get that kind of coverage?
I think the coverage of the story has been, you know, generally pretty responsible. You know, there is certainly an impulse for some journalists to sensationalize stories like this, but obviously the story is as sensational as it is. It doesn't need to be exaggerated at all. And I think there's been, a real maturity of most of the press covering this to sort of stick with the facts, to take their time on this story, to make sure they get everything right, to sort of respect the victims, respect the family, respect the community that, you know, has been impacted by this. So I think that's why you've seen sort of the very kind of slow release of some of these bigger features and some of these bigger stories. And I think it's a good thing. I mean, I think... the police have been, slow to release details, but they have been releasing details, which is not always the MO of some police forces. And I think that's sort of, kept the story going, kept interest in the story, but without sensationalizing it or kind of blowing it up beyond what it needs to be. And I think that's kind of encouraging. I think for all of the frustration that the public can have with the press, I think this story shows that there is still sensitivity and sort of maturity in, you know, how we come about covering, even some of the toughest stories.
One of the reasons I wanted to talk to you, Justin, in particular, is because you were one of the first journalists on this case. Do you remember the first time it came to your attention?
Yeah, I remember in 2013 when the community was first sort of grappling with the idea that there may have been a serial killer in the gay village. I wasn't covering the story then, but I had colleagues who were, and I remember looking on sort of with kind of horror as police announced that they believed these three missing persons cases were connected. You know, in the months and years that followed that, there was really no follow-up. There was nobody checking in. There was nobody going back to the police. There wasn't even news reports when police shut down the original task force, you know, looking into these missing persons cases. And that to me felt like an egregious oversight. I mean, potentially there was a serial killer on the loose, and the media just had not done enough to stick with it. And I think to me that's pretty troubling. So, you know, around 2015, I started kind of making some calls to the Toronto Police Service, trying to track down family members, friends of the missing men, and sort of started looking through old missing persons cases to see if there was others that sort of fit the bill. I kept with that sort of off and on right through to 2017 when I first published, story on Project Houston and these three missing men and sort of the years that had gone by in between. And very oddly, when I was working on that case, I actually had visited the spot where one of the men's car was found, Abdel Basser Faizi. His car was found abandoned on Moore Avenue, which is, you know, maybe about a 10-minute walk from where I'm standing right now on Mallory Crescent. So I spent the afternoon that day, I think in May or June of 2017, kind of driving around this Leaside neighborhood, trying to think of, you know, where he may have gone to, what he may have been doing the night he disappeared. And very oddly, I actually parked just at the end of Mallory Crescent, right next to the house where they're now searching and excavating, and sort of just started walking around. I mean, I may well have seen Bruce MacArthur in the backyard of Mallory Crescent that day. This was probably a month before Andrew Kinzel went missing. Of course, he was the last man to disappear. And just, you know, maybe 8 months before they arrested Bruce MacArthur. So it's sort of surreal to be back here now where, you know, they expect that they may even find more bodies.
So what happens in those years between 2013 and 2017? You mentioned kind of there was no media outcry when the investigation was shut down. The police weren't communicative. Who takes the blame, or is there even any blame, for how long this took to become a real investigation that resulted in an arrest?
Everyone's to blame. You know, I think, you know, whether we're talking about, I think this is something the community, you know, my community is going to have to grapple with, but, the LGBTQ community didn't stick with these stories. The news media didn't follow up on them. The police didn't communicate these issues well enough. The police didn't link up missing persons files well enough. And this is something that is, I think, for me, the most frustrating. After the Picton murders,
13 women went missing from Vancouver's downtown east side. The RCMP descended on Picton's farm in 2002 and launched a massive search that uncovered the remains or DNA of 33 women. But there have long been questions about why police didn't catch Picton sooner or take reports of women disappearing from the downtown east side more seriously.
There was a series of recommendations made to police on how to make sure that people don't fall through the cracks and to make sure that missing persons cases are dealt with and in a wholesome way, to make sure that, the data points are connected and to make sure that somebody like Picton couldn't potentially operate again. And Toronto Police ignored so many of those recommendations. I spoke to Wally Opal, the former judge who actually ran the Picton inquiry. And he was, he was very blunt. He said, so many of these recommendations were not followed by so many police forces across the country. To this day, the Toronto Police Service does not have a dedicated missing persons unit. That to me is unconscionable. We have basically a city police force for Canada's biggest city, where each individual division can operate without talking to the other one. There's so many problems here that are going to need to be sussed through and addressed, but they should have been dealt with 8, 9, 10 years ago, and they weren't. And I think the Toronto Police Service are going to have to answer for that.
There's a lot of discussion in the wake of these murders about the relationship between the LGBT community and the police and whether or not there were assumptions being made sort of during the time leading up to the arrest. What's your opinion, as somebody who's been in the middle of this on both ends, of the relationship that exists there?
The relationship is bad. I mean, there's no two ways about it. You know, it's not as bad as it was in, say, the 1970s. That doesn't mean it's enough progress has been made. I mean, even when the police were asking for the public to come forward and offer their insight and their help and their knowledge on these cases, police were raiding a park in the West End, arresting gay men who were, you know, there, you know, looking for other men to have sex with. And I think the amount of trust that breaks down is impossible to quantify. And I think that that's something that maybe the public, you know, had a hard time understanding. But for a community that had been over-policed and targeted for decades, those arrests meant a lot. The kind of tone and vigor with which the police went after Pride Toronto, after Pride asked them not to show up in uniform, was, again, really hurtful to that relationship. And there's been cases like this for years. And I think the police seem to think that they're owed a certain level of deference from the community, and they don't seem to fully understand what sort of work needs to go into rebuilding that relationship. And that explains why so many people didn't want to come forward. You know, I think that relationship is still going to be fractured. I think it's because police still haven't totally answered for why they didn't follow up in some of these cases sufficiently, for why they didn't look into Bruce MacArthur more aggressively, considering he was interviewed twice between 2013 and 2016. You know, I think those are questions that they're going to have to answer more fulsomely if they want the community to really kind of come around. And I can tell you that there were certain assumptions being made by police that were, I think, irresponsible. They assumed that some of these men had simply vanished or run off. I can tell you that police were actively, I think, pursuing the idea that Abdelbaser Faizi had flown back to Afghanistan. So this is a man who's in the closet, who abandoned his car the opposite end of where his home was, the opposite end of where the airport is, left his passport at home, left his wallet at home, didn't access his phone or his bank records, but they assumed that he had somehow gotten on a flight with a fake passport, you know, unknown money, and gone back to Afghanistan, where being gay could be punishable by death. You know, that theory was ludicrous, and that was a very strong theory that they kept for years. And I think why they decided to rest with that, I think, is still an open question. I don't think that same assumption would have been made of, say, a white woman in her 30s who disappeared. And until there's sort of equality in how those cases are dealt with, and there is going to be frustration.
So as recently as December 2017, police are saying they don't believe there's a serial killer, and MacArthur is arrested in January of 2018. How did you feel personally when you heard of his arrest? Do you remember where you were, what you were doing that day?
I remember I was homesick that day and was you know, floored when I got the alert that they had made an arrest. You know, I still don't know what was going on behind the scenes then. I think there's an equal likelihood that the Toronto police knew full well there was a serial killer, you know, an alleged serial killer in, you know, December 2017, had misled the public because they didn't want to spook, you know, their suspects. I think it's also possible that up until his arrest, they believed that Bruce MacArthur was only responsible for one of the killings. That's probably likely the murder of Andrew Kinsman. I don't know. I hope we at some point get fielded on this. I think that might come out at the trial. But I think there's lots of questions that need to be answered.
What has this done to the LGBT community? Has there been closure on it? I walk home down Church Street and I still see those missing persons posters almost every day.
Yeah, you know, right. I mean, like it has been, I mean, it's hard to understate just how damaging this is. I mean, this is a trauma that I think shook a lot of people. You know, these guys had friends and family and neighbors in the community that were, you know, that were gutted by this. I don't know how the community sort of gets over this. I think, you know, there was a tribute to these men done at Pride, and there will be, I think, probably kind of ongoing conversations about how to sort of make sure that these faces are kind of remembered. But I don't know. I don't think the community knows. I think it's, you know, definitely an open question about kind of what comes next and how the community sort of grapples with this, because I think to some extent there is, you know, some blame directed inward. I mean, how did these guys become so invisible in their own community? You know, how can the community ensure that this sort of thing doesn't happen again for another refugee or closeted man? or persons struggling with addiction or alcoholism. I think that's an ongoing question.
What happens next, and how does it change the timeline? How far are we out from a trial, from anything else being announced? Do you have any idea?
I don't think we have any clue. I mean, this excavation, we were just told, could take weeks. If more bodies are found, they need to be identified. Their ex can need to be notified. That needs to happen. So honestly, anyone's guess is as good as mine. We could be talking, you know, months before we even schedule a preliminary hearing, and that could take months onto itself, which could put a trial out more than a year away, if not longer. We don't know. This could go on for a very, very long time.
Justin Ling, a freelance journalist who's been on the Bruce MacArthur case since before it was a case, joining us from a park bench outside where police are currently excavating to find more human remains. That was the big story. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. Claire Brassard is our producer. Megan Coley is on our social media. Stephanie Phillips is our intrepid research assistant. And Ryan Clark and Tom Ruminski are our editing assistants. You can find us on social media at Big Story Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can, of course, and should subscribe anywhere you get your podcasts, Apple, Google, Stitcher, etc. You can visit us at thebigstorypodcast.ca. Thanks for listening. We'll talk tomorrow.